Team Time.
Welcome to Team Time Table Talks. I'm your host, Debbie Waith, and in this series, I'm going to be speaking with practitioners and experts about working with teams. I'll be discussing what working at the team level means from a practical perspective and how it's affected by increased uncertainty and remote working. My aim in this series is to optimise how we work, think and feel in teams to be more human, hopeful and helpful in our organisations. We'll hear my guests share their real-life experience and expertise in relation to working with teams and get past the soundbites to dig out the learnings and micro-tips that you can try with your teams today. We'll share stories from our practice to help bring our learnings to life, whilst of course respecting our clients' confidentiality. In this episode, I'm going to be speaking with Alex Steele, an academic researcher, consultant and jazz musician who introduces the parallels of playing unscripted jazz into organisational life. He brings the magic of live music to his work, arriving with a piano and band members, and together they enable us to stretch beyond the comfort of our cognitive thinking and knowing about how we work to a place where we see and feel ourselves, the patterns, the preferences, and how that impacts how we work more clearly. Alex describes the importance of an improvisational mindset or our ability to engage with the unexpected, something I think we can all relate to after this last 18 months. He brings a playful, encouraging approach to his work and reflects on the importance for him of energy and culture to try new things, to explore unknowns and to let go of habits. Also important in jazz, where each member plays to unleash the beauty in the whole rather than for their own individual part. The environment and people around us matters when we're working with newness and difference. And it's too easy to fall back on, that's not how we do things, or that would never work here. And most times we don't even notice when it's happening. For novelty and when things aren't happening the way we thought they would, we need to both value and practice behaviours that support difference and change. And Alex tells us how he uses a simple exercise to experience culture and norms around building compared with blocking in how we speak. The yes and yes but game. Maybe this is one you could try with your teams and see what you notice about energy and focus. And how might building versus blocking be important to you if you require innovation or collaboration? Alex has been doing this work with organisations for over 10 years, exploring this bridge between what happens with jazz musicians on stage and improvisation, collaboration, innovation and change in organisations and teams. And I recognise so many lessons relevant for teams reaching for greater performance. Behaviours critical to improvisation, like suspending judgment, how we listen, slowing down. Jazz is in itself a form of conversation, where they each speak the same language. The quadrilogue, as Alex called his four-piece jazz conversation, where there's no leader or conductor, but each share a part in leading, following in silence, predominantly unplanned and spontaneous. And I was struck by the lack of ego in jazz. This wasn't about one instrument being better than another, but the importance of the whole. It throws the dominant view of leadership as residing in hierarchy on its head. Is the world too messy to expect one person to direct us all? It works when there's a plan that we know will work and has worked in the past, and the leader can help us to do the old ways better. But it doesn't seem to fit when we have to work with the unexpected or innovation. In jazz, everyone is a leader and we follow where the energy is. And the learning, I think, is that those with power learn when to step back with humility and let others forward. Alex introduces the beginner's mind and the value in starting from not knowing, loosening or letting go of our expertise, and recognising when our habits and autopilot are no longer serving us, or maybe even getting in the way. The importance of unlearning and relearning as the world changes, and learning to be comfortable in the mess, in the fog, and noticing even how we react in the moment. He helps us to see the world in a different way and accepting the constraints. And as you'll hear in the episode, Alex did an impromptu experiment to demonstrate creativity within constraints when he created a live piece for us with only 4 notes. Alex draws on Rob Poynton's improvisation model, which encourages us to let go, use everything, and to notice more. And I wonder how you might do this in your teams, and what the unplayable pianos in your organisation or team are. How might you approach them differently? And what's the dynamic between leading and following in your team? I hope you'll enjoy this episode, and Alex's passion and energy for working in a more improvised way. Hi, Alex. Welcome to Team Time Table Talks. It's great to have you here today. I wonder if you can share a bit about you and your story and the work that you do with teams.
Okay. Hi, Debbie. Thank you for inviting me here. It's lovely to be here. So I work a lot with teams, and I guess I come at this from a very unusual perspective. I guess if someone asks me what do I do, right now, before I reflect on where I have come from, I will just say simply I do work with teams and organisations and individuals, helping them to become, well, from an organisational point of view, better leaders and better collaborators and better innovators and better at engaging with change through consultancy. And as I'm also an academic and a researcher and a coach. But what's different about me is that I have a parallel life, a double life as a professional jazz musician. And if I look back to where I came from, I grew up in a musical family, and music was the life of me as a child, and all of my family and my parents and their parents. And it was just the normal thing to do. But I had other passions, and I set off on another career pathway as a young man. Interestingly, as an environmental scientist originally and sustainability person, and what was at the heart of that work was about people changing behaviour. And I got really fascinated with the behavioural change side of things, which led me to my professional career in terms of organisational development change. And whilst doing that by day, I was still playing piano. I'm a piano player by night in what used to be the smoky jazz clubs. And for many years, they were completely separate lives, but I realised I had a particular fascination about what happens on stage between jazz musicians as we're performing. And it was probably about 15 years ago when I did my initial experiment with an organisation. And I was just curious to know if I was able to build a bridge between what was happening on stage in terms of collaborating, improvising jazz musicians, and trying to make sense of that for teams and organisations. And it was quite an unexpected success. And so my life has kind of been taken over the last 15 years with this unusual blend of mixing my perspectives and ideas around organisational change and innovation and creativity and leadership with jazz, and specifically improvisation, in terms of you know, what is an improvisational mindset, what are improvisational behaviours and skills that we can use as individuals or within teams and organisations. So that was that's a very, very quick summary of where I've come from, but it does cover a lot of history there. But particularly, as I say, in the last decade, it's taken over my life, because I was only saying to the world, I think there's something of interest here. And people have enjoyed this blend, this fusion of organisational development and live music. Because what I do is I bring a piano with me and a jazz band, whether it's, in the old days, a face-to-face engagement, or these days, predominantly virtual, but it works in both ways. Because there's something magical also. I mean, even if you let go of all of the, you know, the technical or scientific side or the neuroscience of this stuff, there's something very magical about having live music in what is normally a conventional executive education setting. And music really loosens people up. You know, no matter how senior and important and grown up you are, music levels everybody, particularly if you've got a room full of people at different levels, you know, in a hierarchy. Everyone becomes the same, and people start tapping their feet, and So there's a kind of bit of music therapy built into that secretly. So that's what I do. That's where I've come from. And I'm still exploring. I'm still really curious about how to build on the ideas that come from jazz specifically and what we can learn from them within teams. So that's where I've come from.
Fabulous. I mean, it sounds, and I'm sort of eager to sort of jump into some of those words and concepts that you talked about. But I think the hook for me, you know, that being interested in how people change and what changes behavior and trying to understand, you know, the individual psychological neuroscience aspects, but then also the structural systemic aspects at the organizational layers as well. And in particular, what this work allows us to both see and feel and access in a way that when we approach it in a more cognitive way, which is, you know, our usual slideshows and sat around a table, sort of, you know, thinking things through. I'm sort of curious to understand what is it through music, through improvisation, through in some ways kind of the not knowing what's coming. What is it, do you think, that is different in this work for whether it's the individual, the team, or the wider organization?
I suppose it, well, what's different in terms of the work I do when you bring some jazz musicians into the room is that people are kind of shifted to an unknown place. But I try to be a mirror on the audience in an unusual way, so they get to see themselves from an unusual angle. And much of what I do, I talk about, you know, what does it mean to be a great human being, and you know, how do we treat other people, and how do we treat ourselves? It is about the humanity of being in a team or an organization. But I think when people see, the main parallel I draw up front normally is that when you've got, let's say it's a group of four musicians improvising, for me, I often talk about jazz being a language. So what people are observing is a conversation. Jazz has its own vocabulary and grammar, even though the instrumentation is different. There might be a double bass, a drummer, maybe a saxophonist and me on piano. Even though we're playing different instruments, we are still speaking the same language. And so that dialogue, it's more than a dialogue. I've made up a word. I think it's a quadrilogue, because we're all talking at the same time, which is interesting. But what we have in there is a dynamic of leading and following as well, or silence. So, you know, some people can step forward to lead. Some people can step back. And that's the interesting thing about teams as well, in that, you know, many organizations, the leaders are the leaders and the followers are the followers, and they don't kind of, the dynamic isn't the same as in jazz, because leaders some leaders liked being in control, and they hang on to this control, and they're not very good at letting go. And in jazz, whenever someone steps forward to be the leader, and it's completely flat structure, it's not non-hierarchical, that person will lead for as long as they want to lead, saying what they want to say, using the language of jazz. But they're also very happy at some stage to say, I think I've said enough here, and I'm going to step back now. I'm happy to let go of control. And there's a kind of communication between the musicians about who might like to step forward next to take the leading role. And it's, this interesting thing about all of this is it's not planned. It's very, very spontaneous. Well, like this conversation is with us. I mean, you know, we're not using a script. We're just talking the same language and seeing where it goes. And what's, I think, really interesting about jazz is that when people, if you're listening to us play a piece of music, whatever it happens to be, we tend to choose a song. So it can be anything. It can be from any genre, any musical piece you like. But that presents a structure or a framework around which we can begin to have a conversation. So if you're listening to all the notes in a piece of jazz music, I would say that, you know, something like 95% of what you hear is improvised, and 5% of what you hear is the original structure of the piece. People don't often get that. I mean, because if you come to one of our gigs, we can only play a song the same way once. If you asked us to play it 3 minutes later, it would be different. So it's like every piece is like a world premiere. But there's something special about that because other types of music are not like that at all. If you go to a classical concert, you know, all the notes have been written out beforehand and it's beautiful and I think it's wonderful, but it's not, there's no improvisation in there. If you go to a rock concert and you listen to your favourite band play your favourite song, you want it to sound the same as it did last time. But so that's the kind of special thing about jazz. It's that it's the improvisational content.
What you've got me thinking is, I wonder if I'm a leader sat in an organisation, whether how I interact, how we interact, how we our expectations of a leader and leadership are more in the classical or rock lines of, we understand, you know, it's all written out, it's gone before, we understand what's expected. And as you say, people like to hear their favorite song. They like to know what's coming. They like to have, to recognize what they've seen. I'm sort of curious in the sort of parallels, if you like, with organizations in, when we need to be open to improvise and to be in the jazz arena, and when classical or rock, you know, it each serves a purpose, I think. But I just think maybe we're so used to our own genre, and how do we open our eyes to even recognizing what our genre is?
Yeah, I like what you said there. And it's interesting because I think if I'd been doing this kind of stuff 20 years ago, I think organizations were asking classical conductors to come in, or with string quartets, to talk about the role of the conductor and this kind of thing. And I think people, organizations have realized that the world is messy and it's not as predictable as they might have thought with that old kind of command and control model or orchestral model. And as a result, you know, people are talking about, you know, well, the whole VUCA concept of, you know, how do you engage with a world that's volatile and uncertain and complex and ambiguous? Now, that's jazz, isn't it? Jazz is volatile, uncertain, complex and ambiguous. So that's the reality of things. And it's also that, as I said, that dynamic about, you know, where leadership sits in a team or in an organization. And it's, again, the classical orchestral perspective, I think, is most forward thinking organizations know that's not really the way forward. It's interesting because I often run my sessions, and I remember doing a session a few years ago, and I was asked specifically by this organization to talk about the, you know, the jazz model and it being different to the orchestral model. And I was invited on the following day to hear a kind of debrief and a discussion in a big organization. There were probably more than 100 people there, and they had one of these fishbowl kind of conversations. And they started the conversation saying, you know, what did you think of that, the stuff that Alex Steele was talking about? And I sensed from what had happened the day before that people were going, yeah, you know, jazz, this is really important. We need to improvise. We need to be more flexible. However, the first guy that raised his hand said, oh, I hated that jazz. We and he pointed at the CEO and said, I want you to be the conductor. And my heart sank and I thought, oh, dear, this hasn't worked very well. But then what was interesting, he was a brilliant catalyst, having said kind of the opposite to what I'd expected, in terms of everybody thereafter stepping forward saying, no, that is so, you know, 20th century. Mm. The Alex Steele jazz improvisational perspective is exactly what we need. Mm. And so I was, as I say, from a shock at the beginning there, I was really surprised at how people really understood that this is the way to act when, as I said, things around us are so uncertain and unexpected. And I often talk about the what we learn from jazz initially is there are kind of two scenarios in a team, in that I ask the question, how do you deal with novelty is the scenario number one. You know, if someone says to you, I've got this fantastic idea and we really got to try and implement it, but it's a bit radical. How do people react to that? Or an alternative scenario is, how do people react when things go wrong? And again, you know, there's no classical or orchestral model that helps in those scenarios. It has to be an improvisational model. Mm. And so, in terms of error, there's a nice jazz story to share with you. which is a true story. There's one of my favourite piano players. His name is Herbie Hancock, and American piano players. He's 80 years old, I think, this year or last year. About 80, anyway. And been a legend since he was in his 20s. And he wrote his autobiography a few years ago, and he was talking right up front about an early experience that he had on stage at a big concert when he first played with Miles Davis, the trumpet player, who died back in the 80s, I think. But again, another legend and a massive innovator in the world of jazz and improvisation. And Herbie Hancock told the story that there was a big audience there. The concert started. He was only very young, I think, probably in his 20s, one of his first major concerts. So he was a little bit nervous and excited. Mm. And he went to play the first chord in the song with all of his fingers. And he misjudged whatever it distracted him. He played all the wrong notes instantly. So in that moment, I don't know what was going through his mind. He probably thought, my career is over. I'm on a gig with Miles Davis in front of an audience of hundreds of people. I've just played all the wrong notes. And in that moment, Miles Davis turned round during the song to Herbie Hancock, was looking at him with his trumpet in his hand, and he played all the wrong notes back to Herbie in the moment of performing the tune. Mm. And there's a phrase that I think Miles Davis came out with in the 1950s, that there's no such thing as a wrong note, because it's about what you do with the notes in that moment. They might be unexpected, but what does wrong mean? And so, the jazz perspective is to be curious about what's happening, to be playful, and to find value in the unexpected, or beauty. I mean, the mission or the purpose of a jazz team is to make beautiful music, whether that's for the benefit of the musicians or the audience or both, I think. But that's exactly what Miles Davis did in that moment. And so obviously then they redesigned this piece of music in real time and took on the unexpected notes and made them part of the song. And Herbie Hancock, in this autobiography, was reflecting on this. He said for many years about how incredible that was, but how did it happen? And he came to the conclusion many years later that it was about how we judge in the moment, and the fact that, Miles Davis did not judge the notes, he just accepted them. And so, I think these are brilliant lessons for the way we have conversations within teams. Mm. And, we are all trained to be critical thinkers and to make judgments really quickly. But my jazz advice is actually to hang back a little bit and, in the uncomfortableness or in the messiness, and just to see what's there, because I think people do judge very, very quickly, and sometimes too quickly. And in so doing, they can destroy, what could be a fantastic idea for an organization.
Have you noticed any patterns, if you like, when you work with teams as to where they start and where this takes them? I'm sort of thinking more behaviorally. You've mentioned curiosity a couple of times. I'm kind of curious what you've noticed in the teams that you've worked with that maybe are some predominant behaviors or more common behaviors that you've seen. I guess I'm also sort of curious as to, as you go up the levels, whether there's anything that you've noticed in terms of the sort of ability to improvise, the sort of planned versus the emergence.
Yes. Okay. I have noticed changes in behaviours within teams and organisations. And it's particularly, in my line of work, I often get to go in, sometimes just once, and I'm there to inspire, and then off I go. But I'm very fortunate also to have some longer term clients where I get to go back and see what happened as a result. And one of the classic improvisational behavioural things I talk about, I often try to reflect the musical improvisational ideas through language. And there's a classic improvisational reflection on what I was just talking about this idea of judging or not judging in the words yes and yes but, let me assume for a moment that people listening maybe don't know about it. Yeah. I'll explain it really quickly. So you know, if you say to me, I've got this fantastic, brilliant idea, and we've got to do it, and I respond with yes, but this is the non-jazz way, so it blocks this beautiful idea, or to put it, destroys it. Whereas if the response is yes, and which is what's happening when jazz musicians are playing together, like, you know, when Herbie Hancock played with Miles Davis, what that means is, whatever the idea was, it's accepted. So it means I hear what you're saying right now, even if there's a little niggle at the back of your head saying, mm-hmm. what? I hear what you say. I'm going to accept what you say right now. And I'm going to build upon this idea. Mm. And this is something that people can practice, you know, and I often do lots of activities in conversations. When they've heard the musicians have a yes and conversation, I encourage them to try the same thing. And you asked the question about... you know, well, I think you've asked the question, what difference does it make? And so I've been doing some research, which I'm trying to write and turn into a book in due course. I was trying to do that in 2020, maybe 2021, it's going to happen. But what I'm quite intrigued about is with that very, very simple thing about, you know, judging or suspending judgment through trying to do less of the yes, but, and more of the yes, and, what happens inside a team? And so even when people try it for the first time during one of these, you know, experiential sessions, people say, ah, wow, I was, the ideas were really flowing and it was fun. And the energy was really, really high in this conversation. And I've never quite experienced this before, you know, just by changing yes, but to yes, and. People also say it's difficult. They say, oh, I found it really difficult because I wanted to say yes, but all the time. Mm. Or other things that mean yes, but there's other phrases. Or there's even a yes, but face. I've discovered the yes, but face. And when I've gone back, when I've worked with organizations for longer periods of time, and I say, what happened since last time? And they'll say... well, actually, more ideas are being generated within our team now. We've launched a new series of products or services, or we've reached out to a new set of customers, or the classic one is that simply we've become more profitable, and we're happier, and morale is better in our team, and so on. So you might not think that would arise from such a simple thing of being more yes and. But I do say to people, you know, right at the beginning, what kind of person are you, do you think? Do you think you're more of a yes and person or more of a yes but person? And then, you know, what's the culture of your team? Is it a yes but team or a yes and team? And then, you know, the culture of the whole organization. And this is, I think most of the stuff I talk about, by the way, is quite simple stuff, except I think it's really quite powerful. Mm. And if we do, and as I said before, it's about what it means to be human. And we can get into really bad habits, can't we, as human beings? Mm. And yet, if every now and then, if someone drops a little nugget of, like, simplicity and truth about how should you really, you know... Well, yes, and is also about how you listen, isn't it? It's about really, really listening, and it's about slowing down as well, because you can't just jump straight in and say, no, yes, but. It's more like, okay, let me listen a bit more into this. And so I find it really fascinating. So that's... That's kind of the consequence of just that simple thing. Mm. And I think, did you ask the question as well about how this people engage with this at different levels? Is that what you said?
Yeah, well, I was just curious whether you'd noticed anything different, because you'd remarked, you know, so if, when you've got layers in the room, hierarchy in the room, both, I guess, there's expectations of others for the leader to be the conductor. But also, and we don't often talk about it, you know, explicitly, but what power does, because there is somebody higher up in the room. And I was just curious whether in your work, how that those differences show up, really.
Yes. I think it's, again, because of the music being a great leveler, I've found it to be a really great way for people, if there are different levels of a team or an organisation in the room. They actually, they're completely leveled by the fact that we're doing music. And but I should say as well, it's not just the musicians playing songs to a group of people when I run these sessions. they are interactive, and I get members of the audience to control aspects of the music and to disrupt a lot of disruption, particularly, making us go wrong in that previous example of the yes and yes but. So I will get someone from an audience to, well, if they're in a real space, they'll jump on the stage with us and they can do things to us that make us go wrong. But in the virtual world, people can still disrupt us through the screen, and they use visual prompts up with the camera. Mm. But just that, the fact that it's very participatory, it's very interactive. Again, whether you've got, you know, a senior leader in the room, or someone in middle management, or someone from the shop floor, they can all get involved in this funny experience of playing, disrupting the music. Mm. So it is a bit of a leveler. But I think because of this idea that in jazz, you know, anyone can be the leader, then I think that therefore what I'm encouraging teams to do when they're engaging in a jazz and improvisational session is for everybody to have the confidence to step forward and to lead at different times. So again, that's quite useful. And also, I should say, the official leaders have to learn to step back and sometimes be quiet, because a big part of jazz as well is about what notes aren't being played as well as what notes are being played. So being comfortable in the silence. And it's also it's a thing about humility as well, isn't it? You know, being able to kind of step back and let other people step forward. Mm. I think that's well. There's another thought that comes to my mind, which links to just that, which I often talk about, which is about the beginner's mind. And I don't know if you're familiar with that, but what I mean by that is. And this is an interesting thing for senior people, is to let go of their expertise. And there's a nice phrase, which is something like, in the mind of the expert, there are few possibilities, but in the mind of the beginner, there are many. And I often encourage people just to reflect on that for a moment, because we've all become experts in our fields. And the consequence is we start doing things the same way over and over and over again. And as jazz musicians, if we start doing things the same way over and over again, we're going to get bored, and our listeners, the audiences, are going to get bored. That's not what jazz is about. It's about continually inventing and reinventing all the time. Miles Davis, who I spoke about before, and Herbie Hancock are great examples of musicians that continued throughout their careers to reinvent themselves musically all the time. But beginner's mind is an interesting one, because I say to people, for us to be great jazz musicians, we've still got to kind of, what does a beginner do? How does a beginner see the world? And it's about how you sense the world around you. And again, it's about the questions that you ask, particularly, because an expert might just say, oh, I know how you go from A to B. I've done it a million times before. And the step one, step two, step three. But obviously, if you're a beginner, you don't know what is wrong, or you don't know what is right. So, you know, you can be, think of what a real beginner does. You know, a real beginner will be, you know, deeply curious and playful, probably won't be embarrassed if they ask a silly question. And for jazz musicians, I think this is something that we are adept at, because otherwise, as I say, I don't know any jazz musician that would say that he or she is an expert. They say, well, I do what I do, and I'm aspiring to be better, and I'm on the journey, and there's no destination. And human beings, you know, can't always do that. And in organizations particularly. So, you know, that's why it's interesting to work with senior leaders in that respect. And what would it mean to look at the world like a beginner? But it's, you know, it's an interesting thing to do, because I've done lots of personal experiments, you know, where I've put myself in a beginner's mindset or position, and you can feel quite vulnerable, because you think, well, I'm telling the world that the stuff I don't know. Mm. And actually it is okay to say I don't know, and it's okay to try to learn to be comfortable in the mess or the fog. But I think as a leader or within a team, that's a cultural thing, isn't it? So you've really got to empower people around you to say, the beginner's mindset is actually quite valuable because it leads to great discovery and innovation. But there are some uncomfortable bits along the way. But for me, yeah, it's all about the questions that people ask as a result. I think people are much more open to question. So again, that thing about, you know, when you've got more senior people in the room, that can be more challenging to say, you know, how might we engage with a beginner's mindset? And I ask people, you know, is this a valuable thing? You know, and people often say, well, when real beginners come into our team, it's great because they ask all these questions and then they've got great ideas. Of course, how long does it take before they get squashed into a kind of particular space and then they won't ask those questions anymore? Yeah. But I say, listen, I agree that the real beginners are fantastic to have for those reasons. But to what extent can you, as an expert, let go of your expertise and start to see the world like a beginner again? Mm. So, you know, I could ask you, Debbie, you know, how easy would that be to let go of your expertise? And it's a big kind of life challenge to do. And there is that.
And it's one that I think as facilitators and practitioners, that we have to bring with us, because I think in some ways that if we come in knowing what we think should happen with this particular team or in this particular event, I think that there's the balance of there's a structure and the comfort of knowing we've been here before, we've seen similar, but I also don't know because I've never been this point before with these people before. And the bit that I was just going through my mind was how much or the importance that people get comfortable in living with the paradox of both some stability, and maybe that's through your base and what's kind of the beat that's continual throughout, as well as the instability, the what I know, but also comfort with that what I don't know. And so it just strikes me that there's quite a lot of paradox within this, that, you know, just allowing and requiring ourselves to notice what are some of those patterns and what's my preference along those lines of paradox and why do I need both. It just seems like you can open up a whole new conversation depth for that team, for that organization, for that individual, by bringing in just an awareness of the habitualized, the patterns, the preferences. And I love the, as you say, music is that sort of leveler that allows us all access to feel like we can contribute.
Great. And I like what you said there about the paradox, because often it isn't, you know, one way or the other. It's a bit of both, isn't it? It's not either or, it's both and. So, yeah, I'm not saying you have to not be an expert all the time, but it's about being able to go from one to the other, isn't it? So I'm going to be an expert for now. And actually now it's going to be a useful time for me to let go of that because it's really constraining me, you know.
Well, and I'm really sort of curious by the, and how can we be and? I can be an expert and not know, and that's okay. I think that's often the trickiest part for leaders, particularly when they become leaders of leaders. Yeah. Where actually you can't know anymore. And frankly, if you do know, the chances are you're probably getting in the way and are down in the weeds. And so how do you sort of bring yourself out and find that new space through enabling others? One of the things I love about jazz and jazz music is, you know, it feels to me anyway, as the, you know, untrained listener, that it's about enabling the others and the whole, not about, you know, my personal, you know, musicianship and you know how great I am at this particular. It's actually lifting others, and as a consequence we're all lifted.
Yeah, that's a really good point, which we hadn't really discussed, because it's not for individuals doing their own thing at all. It is about, you know, you are one team, so, you know, how do you work in that context to, you have to support each other. You've got to make each other sound great. And there's a huge responsibility to so when I'm backing off on the piano, I'm always supporting what's happening with everybody else because I love the conversation. It's through the jazz conversation. So, and I think when you're looking at professional jazz groups, you know, there's complete humility and love and trust and empathy between the musicians, because they are just one organism together. Whereas if you look at I shouldn't be negative about other styles of music, but I'm thinking of young musicians in a rock band, for example, and young guys want to be, I want to be the loudest, I want to be the fastest, and that's just like kid stuff. It's not the world of that I'm talking about at all. And some people think that that's maybe what jazz is. They see like people on the bandstand, oh, the saxophone player's going now, oh, and the trumpet player. But I would say that's a kind of less evolved form of music. The real music that I'm talking about is with professional, legendary jazz musicians is all about humility and working together.
Mm.
And it's not about competition at all. It's only about collaboration. Mm. So I think that's kind of interesting.
Love, empathy, and trust. There's two of those words show up reasonably often. One's a bit more recent in terms of empathy, but love is one that I think there's still a reticence to bring that into our organizational life as if it's separate from who we are. And so it's an interesting one that, you know, within the, you know, your team, your love, empathy, and trust. And in that order, that was the order that you stated them. And I would be curious to hear, you know, with the teams that we work with, if they were to describe, you know, what was between. I'm not sure love would come into it. And yet it's one of those, I'm not sure it would be said. And yet it's one of those things that's such an underpinning of our humanness.
Yes.
But we kind of package to the side because it's not necessarily appropriate in our organizational worlds and in our professional lives, and as if we can separate these things.
However, I think it's interesting that love is more of a, perhaps it comes into conversations around purpose a lot more than it would have done before, because people are talking about their reason for being or their why. So people might talk about loving their jobs or loving their, you know, the impact that their organization has on the world. So I think they might talk about it in terms of, the purpose of why they're there, rather than, you know, if you like, the way that they, because it is, for me, it's about the way you treat people as well. Mm. You might not use the word love, but it is about a respect for other human beings, and how you listen to them and how you are present with them. So yeah, but otherwise I agree. It's not normally a word I'd use.
And is that what you mean? Because at the very beginning you mentioned an improvisational mindset. Can you say a little bit more about what you mean by an improvisational mindset? And is it something that we all need to have, or can, you know, is that something that should reside in the leader of the team, or like, what is it? Where is it located, and how can we build it?
Yeah, okay. So I did say it, and I think it's something that's a valuable human skill. I mean, it's the ability just to simply to live and interact with other people, and to engage with the unexpected. If you had a book that told you how to, you know, step by step. Well, it's like quality management systems. So like, you know, I remember in the old days, I used to do a lot of work with environmental management systems, like quality management systems. Mm. And they tried to predict, you know, step one, step two, step three, and procedures and instructions and so on. And it's okay with a mechanistic view of the world. But we know, don't we? Everyone knows that the world isn't like that. So I think the ability to engage with, as I said before, with novelty and the unexpected is just a part of everyday life. Mm-hmm. And therefore, all the things we've been talking about are attributes of the improvisational mindset, the yes and approach to mm-hmm. life, the beginner's mind, and plenty of others as well. So, but it's simply, it's this ability to react In the moment. And that thing about being in the moment is also really, really an important part of improvisation, I think, because in the same way that, you know, to have a great conversation, you and I right now have got to be here. Mm-hmm. And I mean, what could happen is I might suddenly think back to, you know, did I answer that question 2-3 minutes ago? Have I said that before? And I've come away from the present moment. Or I might be thinking, I haven't said this really important thing yet. This is going to blow Debbie's mind, and I mustn't forget. And I'm moving into the future. And so, but this is bad stuff. I've really, you know, as a jazz musician, if you're thinking back to what you just played or forward to what you might play, it's going to be a much poorer performance, I think. It can only really work if we're really engaged together in the present moment. Mm. So that's another, you know, interesting aspect of about presence, I think, which is really important, which is about how we listen, isn't it, you know, to each other. Because if you're a fly on the wall with some conversations, people are on different planets, aren't they? That you're watching a conversation and you see conflict arising, and it's because they're not really listening deeply and they're not fully present. Mm. So I think that's really interesting. And I was going to say as well, going back to another part of the improvisational mindset, I was talking about the beginner's mind. It's also about recognizing as an expert that doing things in a certain way may no longer be useful or sensible. So it's about letting go of those ways of doing things, letting go of living, you know, with habits and autopilot. We're all guilty of autopilot kicking in. And sometimes we've got to explicitly recognize that and to unlearn. You know, we might have learned things a certain way, and we've really got to, you know. So going back to music as a piano player, I might be doing stuff and I think, oh, you know, what's wrong with this? And I have to maybe unlearn a whole set of ideas and to relearn or invent something that is more appropriate, because the world changes and we have to do that.
I think there's, for me, a tension, and it's really, you know, it's interesting doing this, having this conversation, you know, 15, 16 months after the start of the pandemic of COVID-19 in the UK, and the tension being sort of from a neurobiology perspective, that actually uncertainty and having to think about all the different aspects that we don't know takes away so much of our energy and our focus. And so automated in some ways is good. It gives us more time, energy, focus on other things. But actually, we've got to kind of take that step back and recognize, sort of from a meta perspective, really, what is it that I do automatically without even thinking, particularly in the times which seem even less certain than before. And so for me, there's this tension of, we're not saying automated is bad, because in some ways that's just our natural response to the unknown. But do we see when that's happening? And bringing up that awareness of the automation and how that can then in organizations get structuralized into how we do things. It's just how we do things.
Yeah. So it's a really good point. So I think we have a personal responsibility to be mindful of the way that we are, because we can be more mindful of how we act and react. Well, I suppose in a team, you could have a culture, an openness, which is to enable people to say these things to each other. So that's more challenging. It really depends on the organization, doesn't it? But if there was a culture of you know, giving people reflection on how they have performed. And of course, interesting, after a jazz performance, you know, I'll sit down with the band and it's more solutions focused. You're looking at you know, success and what's been working well. And the problem-focused conversation is a bit more challenging, isn't it? Because we wouldn't normally focus on what wasn't there and deficits and so on. However, there is a time and place for that, isn't there? So they're more difficult conversations to have. Mm. But I mean, the ability for people to reflect on each other in that way is really valuable. But I think it's quite a challenging one. I don't normally work in that arena myself. I'm more on the solution focused side. Mm. So it's about what's working well and how can we do more of that. It's not about what haven't we got and why is this problem getting worse. It's a very different mindset. But the improvisational mindset, again, it tends to be much more focused on what is there and on solutions. So it's quite kind of interesting.
Can I ask you, I work in a number of sectors that are quite heavily regulated. And I guess as a consequence of that, the way that the organization is structured can feel as though there's less space for improvisation. And I wonder if you're able to share your thoughts on when we have, for good reasons, whether it's safety or financial conduct, etc., when we have a very structured environment, and that translates through to how we meet governance, assurance, committee structures, etc. What's the role and relationship with improvisation when we're working with teams that are in that type of environment? And you know, as you say, there's sort of cultural implications that come from just how do we do things and what's normal around here. Can you speak to improvisation in that kind of environment?
Yes, I can. And that's an interesting context. I think that we often talk about, there's a concept of freedom in the frame, which I work with others around this idea. And so sometimes the constraint is actually quite creative. So I think no matter what the hierarchy and the structure is like, the improvisational quality then is about how you engage with other human beings. So, I mean, you know, even though you've got to work within constraints or a system or a framework, it's not just about following the rules. It's about the quality of the human interactions as you work within that frame. And there's always the opportunity for people to be inquisitive and curious, even with those constraints. Obviously, the more that you push into the idea of improvisation as a nice alternative to structure, there are then possibilities to say, well, should we restructure? And within teams particularly, you know, there's no reason why you can't have a flat structure within the team itself, because what you might find is you've got hierarchy within the team, hierarchy within a hierarchy, which is like challenging. And I found that teams that engage with jazz and improvisation and organisations are tending to try to do that restructuring in that capacity. So, you know, some organisations are better known than others for experimentation in that area around holacracy. And I remember a few years ago, I think I can talk about them because it was well publicised with W.L. Gore. And they were well known for inviting people to work with them and then saying, we're not going to give you a job description. We want you to define what it is that you can do. And you can't become a leader inside their organization until you've got followers. So you've got to therefore go out and talk to people and say, well, I think I'd like to do this and this. And people go, oh yeah, that would be fantastic. And so I thought it was kind of curious that when I worked with them a few years ago, because they were already super, super jazz. And yet there's always further you can go. But yeah, so there's different levels, I think. But many artists and musicians will talk about the constraints of a framework and finding freedom within the frame. So it can happen even in those. And I know the kind of organizations that you're referring to, but there's always scope. Even at the simplest level, about, you know, as I said, how you listen and interact or judge another human being. So yeah, I think it's really interesting.
I think one of the areas that you've kind of prompted me to think about, and it often does come through working with teams, but this feels like it brings it right to the center, is what are our assumptions in how we work around leadership. And I don't think teams necessarily often consciously talk about how do we lead, how do we want to lead, what are the implications for how we lead in our organization. And I like that through through jazz and how you work, you kind of bring that conversation to the fore. So it can be inquired into and explored and understood, and even through that process, it becomes more shared.
Yes, yeah. Just bringing this out into the open for people to reflect upon, mm-hmm. and to be really mindful of the way that they operate and the people around them operate. I mean, they're great conversations to have. And I suppose not every team is ready to have that conversation. I mean, it's, you know, and I guess they come to me when they're already starting to be quite broad-minded, because I'm a bit of a crazy option. You know, they could get some serious professor to come in and help with this stuff, who's an expert in neuroscience and organizational psychology. So when they ask, someone that's, I'm someone that has, if you like, some academic credentials, and also I'm a crazy jazz musician. But when it comes to that time, they're a little way forward, unless someone is facilitating the process on their behalf. And if it's like, for example, an international business school, and they trust the business school because it's full of professors, and then the business school says, well, actually, you know, we're going to bring some professors along, but I'm going to bring this crazy jazz guy along as well. So maybe they're not quite ready for it, but obviously the process of bringing the jazz into the room helps them think differently, which I think is quite interesting.
That kind of speaks to one of the questions that was in the back of my mind in terms of how this, how people ready themselves or come to the thought that this is what we should be doing. Because it is, for some, I think it is a leap, and a leap with great fear, because, as you said, we're really good at judging. That's actually, for many of us, a core competency. And you're saying, don't do that, and expose yourself. And, you know, so there's quite a lot that I can imagine when people, you know, start to explore what this work could be, let alone when they step in the room or turn on the screen. So I'm just curious, what's your experience or your guidance around introducing this kind of working, setting up well with the group or the team that you're going to work with?
Well, I mean, I'm always talking the language of the client. So, you know, so before I do anything, you know, I want to know what their challenges are, and I want to know, you know, what they feel, you know, where they've come from, where they're at now, how people feel within the organization. So, I wouldn't be talking about jazz or improvisation at all. You know, it's about a matter of really understanding, you know, as it would be with any coach or consultant, who you're dealing with and what they think about what's happening. But it's about what they feel as well. It isn't just the cognitive stuff, because I often talk, particularly with the musical stuff, as we do, you know, interactive experiments together. I ask people, how did that feel? You know, and that's an interesting question in itself, isn't it? Because it just opens people up. Everything I talk about, even when I'm talking about crazy jazz, for me, it's I'm always continually building that bridge back to them, and I'm saying, well, you know, if this is a concept which is of value to you, and they're nodding, and I'm saying, well, what might you do differently as a result? You know, what change could you create? Or I talk about experimentation a lot, so, you know, what personal experiment could you try? Or in a team, what team experiment could you try, or an organizational experiment? But it is about, you know, understanding their world entirely. And, you know, whilst I've done some crazy jazz stuff, building that bridge straight back and say, well, here are some tangible things that you can actually do in terms of changing the way you listen, or changing the way you speak, or changing the way you judge, to make your team and your organization better. But again, as I said, at the heart of it, it's because it's about, you know, what it means to be human, which I know is this is the kind of thing that you love as well.
Yeah, that was the sort of whole drive behind this series, was how we can be more human, hopeful, and helpful in our organisations. And so, there's for me, that's such an important access point to organisational life, but, you know, ad infinitum, but particularly this period. I think
it's really
reconnecting
important
with how this has felt, and what this means for what happens going forward, I think is really important.
Yeah. It reminds me as well as about, you know, how to be more human. There is I came across a nice model recently for improvisation, which I often talk about, and then I get people to try it. And it's from a book I read by an author called Robert Poynton, called Everything's an Offer. I don't know if you come across Robert.
Yeah,
and,
I know.
But I like it because I think he wrote that from the perspective of more conventional improvisation and maybe theatrical or stand-up comedy. But I read it as a jazz musician and I thought, well, I like this a lot. He had this model which had three attributes to it: let go, use everything, and notice more. And so I found that really useful because I've been digging into that, reflecting on how do we play jazz, but then how useful that might that mantra be of letting go, using everything, and noticing more inside an organization. And do you know this model?
I've used this as well on leadership development programs as we're sort of setting up for a simulation and encouraging people to identify the things that they perhaps are most interested to explore about themselves. And so for me, this is in the setting it up, is trying to encourage people to sort of leave the judgment and step into the experience.
Yeah, it's really useful, isn't it? So you can say, you know, what do you think you might need to let go of? And in terms of, you know, using everything, what is there at your disposal right now? Because there's a big jazz thing about, you know, working with what's there, which is also an improvisational thing as well. Mm. You know, not wasting your time and your energy worrying about what you haven't got. I mean, this is a big improvisational thing as well. But, you know, it's a really important thing in a team or an organization. You know, what are the offers or the resources in front of us? Mm. And as I say, I do see lots of teams continually saying, well, we can't do this because we haven't got that. And because we haven't got that, we can't do this. But of course, the way we play jazz, we've got what we've got in that moment. We've got the notes and the harmonies and the rhythms, and we use them. And again, an interesting experiment to do with an audience on one of these sessions is to get them to chuck unexpected things at us in different ways that it might ask us to incorporate a random chord or a note or even a whole song. And they might say, chuck in Bohemian Rhapsody from Queen while you're playing this song. You go, ooh, okay. But you work with what you've got, no matter what's there. And there is another classic story from the 1970s of a famous piano player called Keith Jarrett. And amazing piano player. And in 1975, he was asked to play a solo piano concert at the Cologne Opera House in Germany. And he was very famous throughout his whole life. And particularly then at the beginning of his career, for turning up at a concert hall and sitting down on a piano by himself and playing a 100% improvised concert, no structure. He would just sit down and then focus, be present, and start to play. Okay, wow. And he was also very particular about, you know, what kind of piano he would want. He asked for, I think, a Burzendorfer Imperial Concert Grand Piano, beautiful piano. And he got to the concert and the piano wasn't there. And the organisers apologised, said, oh, there's been a bit of a mix-up. But we've got this other little baby grand practice piano. Will that be okay? And of course, his initial reaction was like, no way am I going to play this little baby grand piano. And the organizer said, well, would you just have a look just in case? Could you just try it before the concert starts? So he said, okay. And he went to have a look and he found that it was out of tune. Several notes weren't working and the pedal that gave it sustain was faulty. So he said, I can't do it. But then, of course, what obviously clicked into his mind was, you know, let go, use everything, notice more. And he thought, well, this is what I've got to work with. There are a lot of people that have just turned up. I think 1,400 people were taking their seats. And he was persuaded to do the concert. And his producer from ECM Records had said, was intending to record the concert. So Keith Jarrett said to the producer, said, listen, I'm going to do the concert, but whatever you do, don't record it. I don't think it's going to be good, but I'm going to accept my constraints and I'm just going to play the concert. He obviously was fully in the moment and sat down at this piano and he worked with what was working. So, you know, he avoided the notes that didn't work. And he found that because it was a small piano, he had to change his posture and the way he pressed it, his weight behind, you know, pressing down the piano keys. Everything about his posture changed. And he had to play in different parts of the piano where he wouldn't normally play as well. But of course, he made the most of that. And so he actually did play something quite beautiful. So beautiful, in fact, because what happened was his producer decided to record the concert anyway. He just ignored Keith Jarrett saying, and he said, oh yeah, I won't record it, but he did anyway. And it was the most incredible concert because he'd never played like that before. And I don't think he's played like that since because of the uniqueness of the constraints of the piano. And this to this very day, this was 1975 it was recorded, it's still the best-selling solo piano, jazz piano album in all of history. I mean, it's quite a remarkable feat of creativity. But I think that's just a really interesting thing about going back to that model, you know, let go, use everything, notice more. I mean, that's exactly what jazz musicians have to do, but that's what Keith Jarrett did on that particular occasion. And I often talk about, you know, this is the story of the unplayable piano. But of course, it wasn't unplayable, was it? Because Keith Jarrett did this beautiful thing with it. And so you could say to a team or an organization, well, what do you think of the unplayable pianos that you face? Which actually, if you look at this with an improvisational mindset, may not be unplayable. It might be quite playable and will encourage you to look at the world in a different way. And, you know, and that's an interesting thing. And again, musically, I'll often ask people to challenge the band in a similar way. I don't like them to smash up my piano, I should say, but in other ways, giving us constraints. Like, you know, they might say, for example, well, we only want you to use three notes. And then we'd say, okay, you know. So, and that, actually, Debbie, if you wanted, I'd be happy to try a completely spontaneous musical experiment with you. We could even do it now because, what did I just say then? I said, well, for example, Keith Jarrett had the constraints of the unplayable piano. What might be those constraints for me? So if let's say I asked you to give me four random notes and then I could, I mean, I don't know if this is going to work, but I could sit at my piano, which by the way, for the listeners, I've got a digital piano behind me. And I'd have to move back to the piano if you wanted me to do this. But now, Debbie, are you a musician, by the way? Do you know about music?
I learned an instrument as a child. And so I can read music and I can play a couple of things, but not as an adult particularly.
So you know what, you know about sharps and flats and natural notes, and you know it goes from A up to G,
yes,
with flats and sharps and naturals along the way. So if you wanted to pick four random notes, but I probably won't remember them. So I've got a pen in front of me. So I'm going to write. If you shout out four random notes to me, I will see if I can make something beautiful from that. But this is another example of, if you like, freedom in the frame. This is going to be a real kind of narrow constraint. And it's my starting point, but I will, you know, I'll let go of anything because this will be 100% improvised and I'll notice, you know, any beauty that comes along the way. So I've got a pen in front of me. What are you going to go for?
So my notes are going to be B flat.
Yeah.
C, D, F. F sharp.
Oh, C, D and F sharp. Okay. I like that. Shall I try this now?
Yeah. That'd be great.
Okay. Let's have a go.
Let's get yourself set up.
I think my piano is switched on behind me. Right. So I hope you'll still be... I'll just assume that you can pick this up from the microphone. It should be fine. And let's see what happens.
Okay.
So B flat, C, D and F sharp. I'm going to start with those notes and we'll see what happens.
Okay.
I'm a little bit excited. Thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
Well, I've no idea what that sounded like.
Well, that it was really interesting, actually, because at the start, there was that sort of a minute or so where you're obviously exploring your restriction and getting familiar with it. And it did feel as though it there was kind of just that period where it didn't quite... it was hard to find the rhythm, hard to find the what was happening. And then you just kind of got into this melodic, and it seemed within the constraints that there was a comfort and a confidence that built, and then it explored, and then it started getting more sort of more interesting, nearly more sort of like, I don't know, it was just really interesting. It made me think how much we don't say yes, you know, when we're presented. So you said, what are your unplayable pianos in your organization? But when we're presented with them, what do we do? Yes. And what it takes us to say yes. But then when you do say yes within those restricted conditions, to give people time and space to find that confidence and that comfort and the beauty in the restriction. Whereas if we judged it only on the first minute, when it was still sort of like, we're still exploring here. But I just wonder how much we cut off in the first minute. Go, oh, that didn't work. Move on.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly. And that's how it felt for me to do that as well. And in fact, I did feel a need to not make it too long. So actually, I was just starting to find the flow, but I thought, maybe I've played enough now. So I probably personally didn't have enough time or space to do that justice. However, you could see the evolution happening. And interesting for me, as I was exploring, it was towards the end, and I thought, oh, this is something, I found another thing. But I thought, I bet you don't want this song to... I could have played that for 20 minutes. So I thought like 2 minutes was probably enough. But the spirit of what you said is really important, isn't it, in life? If we could have the freedom to do that. But we need to be, you know, people talk about psychological safety. You know, you need to be in a room of people, whether it's listeners or other musicians, that will allow you to do that as well without you feeling... that you know you shouldn't be doing that, or you know you've gone on for too long, or whatever. That culture is really, really important, isn't it? Mm. Of allowing, you know, exploration and experimentation within constraints. Mm. So it's a beautiful thing. So people need to continually do that, don't they? Ask you know, what do I need to play with that isn't really as unplayable as I think. Work with what's there. You know. And there's also a phrase, actually, that I sometimes use in the jazz context. You know the conventional phrase is something like if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And the jazz thing is something like if it ain't broke, break it. And that's kind of, that is jazz, isn't it? Because we don't like playing the song. We can't play the song the same way twice. And Or even if we've heard a recording of ourselves playing something, we would never want to play it again that way. Mm. We'd think, I've done it once already. So we're continually on the edges. Well, not just at the edges. We're in the middle and on the edges, looking at stuff to break, because we're curious about saying, well, how else could we do this? It's a continual quest for novelty and difference, but as long as it's beautiful, there's still a purpose behind it. It's to provide value or beauty in our notes and harmonies and rhythms. So, but that culture of asking how else or what else, I think is really, really, really crucial. You know, but that's for innovation and growth within a team as well. Because if you don't do that, you just get boring or irrelevant.
Can I ask? Do you have a micro practice that people who are listening to this in teams could take and use with their own teams in the spirit of the philosophy and the mindset of improvisation?
Well, I think the best micro practice is the yes and one. I mean, I would encourage everybody to to be really clear about what the context is for a conversation. It could be a team meeting, or you know, this could be something that people could do at home. You know, around the dinner table. You know, with your partners, your family, your kids, or whatever, and say, let's have a conversation for the next. Let's make it 10 minutes, and in that time, we are not allowed to say yes, but. And let's see what happens. And every time people I know that practice this, whether it's in an organisational or team setting or at home around the table, is that the energy and creativity that's created by not judging, which is, you know, but that's the whole point of having the yes and conversation and actively trying not to say yes, but that is an incredible micro practice, which is very simple to do, which people can feel instantly the impact it has. And you could even fine people. You could say you're going to fine you at least one pound every time you say yes, but, and see how much money you raise for your local charity while you're doing it.
And any derivative of yes, but, it's the howevers. It's, you know, it's all the ways that we've become quite sophisticated, I think, at not saying no and not saying but actually the impact is the same.
So it's
catching, you know, maybe it's £2 for the more sophisticated ways of trying to not, you know, enter into the spirit of the game.
Yeah, I think £2 would be for a phrase like with respect.
Yes.
Because you think at first, you think, oh, that's nice.
If I can be devil's advocate. That's one I hear in some organizations quite a lot. So what, Alex, what are you hopeful for as you look ahead?
Well, I'm hopeful that people learn to improvise more, that they actually are curious about what it means to, you know, to interact in an open way with other human beings, and to really, so that people listen more and that they're more curious. And I guess it's also having a confidence to leave your comfort zone more. So I'm hopeful that people are braver. But at the same time as being brave themselves, they are surrounded by people who understand this culture and that they are supportive of that. So everyone is kind of, and again, it's how the jazz band works, isn't it? You know, when I go off on a tangent on a piano solo, I know the other musicians in the band have kind of got my back as I explore to completely unknown territory, because they're not just doing their own thing. They're listening to me and they're supporting me all the way. They're coming with me on that journey. We are just like one entity at any moment in time when we're performing jazz. We kind of lose. We do actually. That sounds kind of spiritual, but you lose your sense of self because you are one. And so I would be hopeful that people could experience that in their own teams as well, and that they are learning to be, and in learning to improvise, you know, to be better listeners, to be more present, and to be more trusting of others as well. Wow, that'd be a great world to live in.
And as you think of ways that we could be more helpful in our own teams, what comes to mind?
Well, we've got to practice this stuff, I suppose. It's what I said, I suppose, creating that culture as leaders, you know, supporting others to explore, you know, things I said, like beginner's mind, or, you know, what can we let go of, or what do we need to, you know, where is the autopilot, you know, but to have these conversations, I think, is what's helpful. So that, you know, because talking about error, you know, there might be a tendency in some organizations to sweep things under the carpet pretty quickly and not talk about these things at all. And so it's having this culture of openness, I think, isn't it? Where, again, it requires humility, but also acknowledging that, you know, people might feel some vulnerability as well, I think, about being so open, particularly, you know, letting go of expertise and saying things like, I don't know. You know, I don't know, but however, let's find out together. So it would be helpful, I think, if people were of that collaborative mindset to be experimental and to be curious together, and moving away from having to have all the right answers. So that it would be really helpful if people were open and talk more, listen more.
And thinking of your role in a jazz band and, you know, as someone who works with improvisation, what inspires or galvanizes you?
I think it's interesting whether it's in jazz or in life. I mean, what I'm really driven by is how we create energy within ourselves and how we energize others. And I know that people talk about concepts of best self. And for me, when I think about who's my best self, it is about the energy that I have and that I put out into the world. Because we know, I think people in teams know the exact opposite of this are the people that walk into the room and suck the energy out of the room. I've heard them called the mood hoovers. They go like the Dementors and Harry Potter. And you don't really want many of them in your team, really, do you? Because there's the opposite of the best self, I think, is understanding of how energy works. And I mean, that happens in jazz when we're performing. You know, I can really raise the energy of the whole band by how I play, as every other instrumentalist can do in the band. And it's interesting because in terms of what inspires me and or galvanizes me, when I'm out in the world, whether it's musical or not organizations, I mean, I do like the energy of younger people. Okay, so I'm going to be a bit ageist for a second here, even though I'm an older fella, because there is something really fantastic about. I was working with a bunch of very young leaders recently, all in their 20s. And I thought, wow, I don't often see that enthusiasm, that passion and that zest. And then I was reflecting on it. And actually, I was thinking, well, of the most inspirational leaders I do know of any age, of course, they haven't really let go of that ability to energize themselves and the people around them. So what inspires me is that ability to energize. So I was saying, I was thinking at first, it's a thing about younger people, but actually it is actually right across the whole age range, because I know there's a bass player I work with a lot who actually used to play with Frank Sinatra in the 1960s. He's a good mate of mine, great bass player. He's 87 years old, and I'll be gigging with him, and I wouldn't know that he wasn't the same age as me. But the energy that he has in his normal conversation and in the way that he plays the bass is really remarkable. He's, you know, quite an inspiration. So I think being mindful about how we are with our own energy is something that is really important. And I'm always inspired by people that energize me. And I think my role in going out into the world is to energize others in the same way.
Well, you've been inspirational yourself today, Alex. I've really enjoyed hearing about the work that you do and how this helps organisations and leaders and teams get a better sense of themselves, quite honestly. And what you're leaving me with is a notion of the spirituality within leadership and how much we can access through music and through letting go more, both ourselves and you know, allowing ourselves to encounter and be seen and be felt more in a different way. We've lived a long time where we separate the purpose and the delivery from the humanity, and I think there is something about the gift is in bringing the two together. And you know, my feeling for your work is in the bringing those two worlds together. So thank you so much for your time today.
It's been great. Thank you so much for inviting me to have the conversation. And but I should say I'm inspired by your work as well. I've got to know a bit of your work in the since we had our first conversation, and we're working in the same territory, of course, aren't we? We're just trying to make people to be more amazing, brilliant human beings. So thank you so much for inviting me, and I'm looking forward to another conversation somewhere along the way. Plus, make sure you come to my next jazz gig, whenever that is. I don't know when it is, but please come.
Well, we're going to be putting up how to get in touch with you on my website, www.debbiewaith.com. And so let's put up, whenever you've got that date, let's get that on there, and then people can know how to see you play live and with others.
That would be wonderful.
Thank you so much, Alex.
Thank you so much.
Take care.
Thank you.
I hope you find this episode as inspiring as I did. Alex's energy is truly infectious, and I think every team would benefit from having more courage and playfulness in how we approach our work. Thank you, Alex, for your musicianship, your humanity, and your challenge to help us embrace our improvisational behaviours and skills, to notice more, to use everything, and to let go. And how did you get on with your questions? Perhaps you might take a moment to consider. How might you use let go, use everything, and notice more in your team? And what are the unplayable pianos in your organisation or team, and how could you approach them differently? And what's the dynamic between leading and following in your team? And what might playing with those dynamics enable? Details of how to get in touch with Alex and any references from this episode are on my website, www.debbiewaith.com. I'll be releasing a new Team Timetable Talks every Tuesday. We'd love for these to be accessed by all those who you think would be interested by sharing on your favourite platform. And remember to subscribe to not miss the latest episode. Thanks for listening, and I wish you a hopeful and helpful week ahead. Goodbye.
Subscribe to Team Time.